working and well, it's running, but maybe now it is. Okay.
It is working?
Yes. Yes, you can hear it just fine. From time to time, I just check it. This monitors the tape itself.
Right.
So, all right, I guess we're ready to begin then. Let's start by saying that today is February 23rd, 1992, and this is Jim Boning speaking with Dr. O.A. Batista in his office at in Fort Worth. Dr. Batista, I know that you were born on June 20th, 1917, in Cornwall, Ontario. Could you tell me something about your parents and your family background?
Yes, that is the correct birth date. My mother and father actually immigrated to Canada from Italy. I never knew my grandparents. They never came to this country. All I know about my ancestry is that on my father's side, there was French and Italian background, and on my mother's side, there was Spanish and Italian background. That's all I know. My mother came over under the auspices of an uncle, and my father came over independently. And they got together, I don't know how, but anyhow, that's how they got married. They never knew each other before they met in Canada. My father was a stonemason by trade, and he worked for the Canadian government all of his life, patching canal walls and things like that. Neither of them had a high school education. My father could not read English until after a lot of experience, and but both of them were built of unique tissue, so to speak. They emulated in the eyes of us the most wonderful virtues of parents, completely unselfish. Very little money. They would stretch their money amazingly. And in the winter times, of course, in Canada, the canals were frozen. So my father had to have a 4 or 5 month layoff during which he would do all kinds of manual chores to pick up some extra money. But he also was a great gardener, and there was a lot that we owned next to our little home. And he grew the most wonderful vegetables, fresh vegetables, and stocked up so that we would go through the winter with enough food. But by that I mean a pot of vegetable soup that would last for a whole week. And of course, the entire family ultimately was 6 boys and 2 girls, so there was a family of 10. And
Where were you in the 8
children? I was number 7. And my brother Arthur, the neurosurgeon in New York City, who got his MD at McGill, was 8. Both my mother and father lived to very elderly ages, late 80s. And he was a very hard worker. He would walk to his job. He'd always be on the job 1 hour before working time. But he would have to walk 5 to 6 miles in the snow. And, Jim, I can remember him coming home at night with icicles on his mustache, 5 inches long from the vapor freezing. Never complained, never. And my mother, she was a wonderful person, completely dedicated to the family and to her husband. Took the back seat on everything, but really delivered the goods. Boy, she would take in sewing on top of all of her family duties, patch workman's pants. And from that money, I remember so well, the insurance man would come around, and from her sewing money that she would save in 10-cent pieces, it was 10 cents every 2 weeks for each child's life insurance. And boy, she would have that for him every time. I would just wonderful persons. So all they could give us was paternal love, but no money. And I'll never forget the day I left to go to McGill University. My mother and father hugged me and said, "We have no money, and but we are so proud that you are going to get your brain changed and increased, you see." And the facts are that I worked my way through McGill by a procedure I'll tell you about, but it was McGill that gave me a bursar of $300 a year, which paid for my tuition. Now, most people, it's a different world we live in now. My brother Arthur, the baby of the family, he and I shared a small bedroom in Strathcona Hall at McGill. Now, Arthur would work as a guard in the most severe mental institution in Montreal, the Verdun Hospital, at night, in order to get enough money to buy food while he was going to medical school. He would try to get a little nap now and then at the hospital. But this is the kind of character that our parents built into us. And it's remarkable. Here, two completely uneducated human beings with great, great qualities, who they were able to instill in us something that other parents miss instilling. And, you know, my brother Arthur and I and Joseph, we had to sleep in a small bed, and I usually got in the middle because I was the middle. And these little beds, my mother would make the mattresses from the corn husks every fall that my father grew corn. And she would wash the husks and soften them and make them. But here, three to a small bed, often one of us would fall out. But that went through. We never complained. So,
did you grow up, and forgive me for my ignorance,
yes,
Canadian geometry, but where is Cornwall?
Cornwall is between Montreal and Kingston along the St. Lawrence River. It's about 80 miles from Montreal, and going north, it's about 70 miles from Ottawa. But it's a little town right on the edge of the St. Lawrence River.
And did you spend all of your childhood there before you went to McGill?
That's right. Every bit of it. I had a newspaper route that was very important to me at that time. And then also I served for 11 years as a caddy in the summertime. And it's interesting, Jim. I developed a scientific bent as a caddy, you see. Nobody taught me this. But Muriel Lester, who was a very wealthy woman, a wonderful lady, young lady, she insisted on having me as her caddy. So she would take me on tournaments in her limousine, you know, and for me as a poor boy, this was really unbelievable. But it was no secret. Many people would ask for me to caddy, because when I was a caddy, I had enough common sense to line up the ball with a tree or some obstacle in the rough, and I wouldn't take my eye off of it until I got there. That increased the chances of finding the ball. So they used to call me Eagle Eye. And there was a dentist that came up from U.S. every summer to the Cornwall Golf Club on his way to play, but he would always ask the pro for me to be his caddy, because he said, "This fellow finds a ball, it's unbelievable, you see." But always using a little common sense. But there was some science to it, you see. Lining your eye up and staying on it. So, and then I, the Batista family, six boys, we, over a period of 30-some years, we were one block from the Hotel Dieu Hospital. And of course, my parents were very, very strong Catholics. And starting with the oldest boy, we served Mass in the chapel of that hospital, the Batista Boys, over a period of 30 years, one after the other. I did for 11 years. At 6 o'clock in the morning, in the coldest weather, knee-deep in snow sometimes, my parents would get us up one at a time and in sequence. And the Hotel Dieu nuns took a liking to me, and they had their own farm. And after Mass, they would let me come down to their kitchen, and they would give me oatmeal, but with real fresh cream from the cows. Oh, I can remember those. They were so wonderful. The just as an aside, I was, of course, named Orlando Aloysius Batista. And with a name like that, the nuns were sure that someday I would become a pope. So I got sort of royal treatment because of that. That was a very interesting experience. And my brother Arthur followed me as I got older, and the nuns were so appreciative. When I was 11 years old, I had a terrible amount of intestinal pain. And of course, then we didn't know. My mother would collect herbs in the fields and make a tonic, and it helped me. But I would come home from school in great pain for years. And then one day, the pain got extremely severe. And dear Dr. Alguire, the good hometown physician, came and he felt my stomach. And he said to my father, he said, "You get this boy over to the hospital. We must operate immediately." My father carried me on his back, walked over. I was 11. And Dr. Alguire operated very promptly. My appendix had burst. It was appendicitis all the time. Now, just amazes me when I think back. Of course, the nuns were praying at my bedside constantly, you know, candles. But that operation, there was adhesive bandages, big incision, which I still have the record of. And I was in that hospital for 6 weeks with appendicitis. Mm. However, I'm very fortunate to have lived, because there was no, usually a burst appendix in those days, you were a goner. And if Dr. Alguire didn't operate as promptly as he did, I'm sure the infection would have spread, and you wouldn't be talking today. Just one experience after another like that, I remember all of that very clearly, because it was such an impression.
Where did you get your early education?
At the
Catholic schools?
The elementary was at the Catholic school, but the more formal education was at the Cornwall Collegiate Institute, because the Catholic schools didn't have high schools, they only had the elementary. They started to have them a little later, but Cornwall Collegiate Institute, a very fine school, is where all of us got our high school training.
At a public school?
Yes. Yes.
Were there any teachers, you've mentioned the nuns, were there any teachers in either your elementary or high school experience that had an influence on you?
Yes. Primarily in the high school area. The one teacher I told you about, Miss Tobin, was a very unique experience, and I have no malice towards her whatsoever. She was doing her job, but I was just a stubborn, budding scientist who was challenging everything, and they're not accustomed. They're accustomed to, most leaders like that don't want young kids challenging what they're supposed to know. And then there was another teacher, Miss Bartlett, who taught Latin. And I guess I was at the adolescent stage. She was an extremely pretty woman and very, very helpful in me learning Latin. This was long before I met Helen, of course. And I remember mulling, you know, the day that she made the announcement that she was getting married and would be giving up teaching. And I thought, oh, what a loss, you know. those are the two main ones. So I
would you mind relating that story about Miss Tobin again?
No, I'd be happy to, because I think there's something fundamentally significant in this little anecdote. A teacher is almost as important as a parent in determining the future career of their students. They may not realize that, but it's true. So I, at that age, was particularly, I read a lot. As a matter of fact, as I think I may have mentioned, my father laid the rule down very early in each of our lives that they wanted us to do everything possible to develop brain power. They would keep saying, without your mind, you will always be a laborer. You must study. You must learn knowledge. We didn't. We want you to. And my father, for all of us, made a rule that if we were studying or reading a book, that he would never ask us to do manual labor, that he would do it for us. Shovel the snow, cut the grass, or tend furnaces, or whatnot. And if you look at the pattern of the six boys, the two girls got married, had families, and have since passed away. But if you look at the career of six boys raised in a very poor environment, my God, we if we ever got a an unusually full course meal, it'd be once a month, you know, as a treat or something. So we had porridge every morning, and we had beef soup at night, and that was it. And so the six boys, to give you an illustration, and then I'll tell you about Miss Tobin, is my top brother became a successful real estate agent. He stopped at high school. The second, Donald, became, he was a professional hockey player for the Houston team down here. He left school and home, excuse me, without going to high school. He, in grade school, he had a horse called Sambo. I was scared stiff of him. That he had a bread route. There was a bakery right behind our home, and Sambo lived in one of our in our garage barn, and he'd get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and hook him up in the winter time and deliver bread to homes around the place in the end of grade school. So he left home and made his own career, and was a professional hockey player, but he also created his own knowledge as he was a wonderful bakery. He had a bakery that, you know, wonderful. Then the third boy became chairman and president of Courtauld's Canada. And he really was the spearhead in 1933 for the family. And I remember the exultation when he bought a 1933 Dodge, because he had been appointed chief chemist at the time of Courtauld's. And he asked me if I would drive it home from him when the ship brought it in. And I am telling you, you'd think you were driving a limousine, you know. And that was the whole family, it was the first break in terms of financial money coming in. And he helped me some part through McGill University, and I paid him back with interest. And then my brother, Joseph, he entered the Jesuit novitiate after 2 years at Queens. And then I came along, and then Arthur. But here's Arthur, one of the world's most famous neurosurgeons. He's developed some new techniques for creating nerve endings. For instance, they're coming to him now at New York University from all over the world. In a car accident, or if a neurosurgeon is sloppy, they can cut nerves here. And the effect of it, that particular bunch of little nerves, is that the patient's hand can never move. It's going to stay that way for life. Now, what he did is he's found a way of connecting the nerve endings. And he and I have a two-hour meeting every 2 weeks still. And then the minute the nerve connections are made, the arm, and you only need 10% connections. Nature always provides a great abundance of protection, so that if he can guide the severed endings so that only 10% match, the other 90% may not be connected, it'll work. He did the same thing for Bell's palsy. I've watched him operate where this person's face was twisted. And what he does is, and I hope this isn't too big a diversion, but what Arthur developed was, he takes, and Arthur's now 71, he takes a dye program and he finds the arteries that are clear here. Again, nature's abundance. Now, he's talking about 1 millimeter arteries. So what he does, and I've watched this, it's miraculous. He takes and cuts out the artery leading to the brain here that's plugged, literally plugged, and that's why the message isn't given. He takes a 2-inch strip out of the abundant good part and anastomoses it in, and that person's face comes back in front of you like a miracle. Mm. Unbelievable. The world doesn't know about these things. That's what I want to do more writing on as I can. And I've done a lot, but I know so much more now I could interpret it better for the public. So that's the horror. Now here, out of this little family, poor family, my father never made more than $50 a week when he worked. These two wonderful people not only had 8 children, but what they did for them. Boy, I mean, this is a story that should be told to young people today. Today they expect everything on a silver dish, and that's why they lose. That's why I'm here 7 days a week, 15 hours a day. I love my work. I would rather be here than in a palace anywhere. I wouldn't take it. I wouldn't trade it for anything, you see. But they don't, if you don't learn that from first-hand experience, you can't get the thrill of it. Exactly. I've got more thrills out of my scientific research, and seeing it applied makes every other pleasure in this world ridiculous. So there's the family background. Now we'll go to Miss Tobin. I'm sorry to have diverted, but it's part of the genesis of the whole history. Now, Miss Tobin, like a professor that I had at McGill University, was extremely dedicated to her subject. She worshipped it. And her subject was ancient history. And she would get into tears at times telling us stories about ancient history. And I would always, on my history exams, say things that she didn't like. You know, I'd say, I don't think this is right, because there's a conflict here. The two people don't agree. And then I took the issue of the War of 1812 with her. And this annoyed her very much, because you're not supposed to challenge a teacher when you're in, I think I was in fourth grade high school at the time, because she said she wouldn't let me graduate if I didn't change my attitude towards ancient history. Well, I haven't to date. Anyhow, so she made me take a summer school course to get through. Otherwise, I would not have graduated from Cornwall Collegiate Institute. But I remember at the end of the fourth year, she told me, she had me come up in front of the class, and she, you know, I was small in stature, and she would point to the class and say, "Now this boy is so stubborn, he will not like ancient history. He ignores it." And she said, "I predict that he has a dismal future, and he'll be nothing but a ditch digger the rest of his life." But to do that in front of a class is rather improper. But I don't have any. I mean, it's an interesting anecdote, but she was still a wonderful teacher, and in her own way, suffering from the beginning of Parkinson's disease, that's enough to make anybody aggravated at times.
Did you have any, what was your science experience like in high school?
And
you
in said, high school?
Yes, and you said your brother was a chemist. I'm looking for the connection as where the origins of your interest in science began.
The best answer I can give you to that is, now this is the truth, and I don't think I've even mentioned this to anybody before, but it comes back as a result of your question. My brother Arthur, he would sit in our tiny little living room reading all the time, and he was 13 at the time. And he turned to me and closed the book. He was reading one of Paul de Kruff's books. Mm-hmm. And even before that, in our mud cellar, Arthur would, in the dark of the with a lamp or something, would dissect guinea pigs to get the skill that he had. But anyhow, he turned to me. I remember it so clearly. And he said, "Landy, I've just made up my mind. I'm going to become a neurosurgeon if it takes me 30 years. Well, it took him more than 30 years to get to where he is. But that's where the spark came from. When I was 14, I created an inventors cooperative company in Cornwall. I even have letterheads of it, where I wanted to get the inventors in Cornwall to get together to help each other, because when I was between 13 and 15, I was just full of ideas. And we would discuss things among the family, mostly, what can we do to make things better, you see? And honest, this is what happened. All of us, I wanted to be a physician, but I knew that Arthur, from when he said, and both of us could never get through medical school at the same time. We were only 2 years apart, 2.5 years apart. And what happened at that time was, I was just full of ideas. And I also was doing a lot of writing. I wrote 4 novels when between 12 and 16. Mm. And and I have here, I may show you, a 3-row Empire typewriter made in England that I paid $6 for from the barber who cut our hair from my newspaper earnings. And I typed 6 novels on that little typewriter on yellow paper, and I still have them. And darn it, the novels are good. One was called The Night Before Eternity. What would happen, indeed, I was very religious then, what the world be like if we knew that the end of the world was going to be 24 hours, and I described the night before eternity in the novel. And then I wrote a detective manuscript, about 300 pages, Braden Cascade, the detective scientist, a scientist solving mysteries. This is, you know, we're talking way back in the 1920s or late 20s. So This is the most exciting career of mine in memory. For example, I wrote to the Ford Motor Company, and I said, because the man next door used to take us out for a ride in his Model T Ford, and I said, why don't you have a thing on the front of the car so that the man can push it and a sign would go out to tell you you were going this way, and the same thing could tell you so that people would know which way you were going to turn. And then they'd put out their hands, and sometimes they didn't. Oh, gee. They wrote back and said, you know, because I told them I was 14 or something like that. And so they wrote back, and they sent me, as a gift for writing to them, a Boy Scout flashlight, because I could never join the Boy Scouts, and we had no money. And boy, would I ever love to carry that around and show it, you know. But then I wrote to the Wrigley Spearmint Chewing Gum Company, and I said, you know, your spearmint gum, it sticks, and it's hard to get the wrapper off. Why don't you coat it with some starch so that you wouldn't get sticky? Gee whiz. I got a huge carton of spearmint gum that I fed the neighborhood for years as a thank you. And then I wrote to the Goodyear Tire Company, and I said, look, the man next door has a Model T Ford, and he invites us out for a Sunday ride, and about every 3 miles he has to change a flat tire. Why don't you make a tire with two tubes in it, so that if one tube gets punctured, you'd still have enough air to get going? They sent me something back. The other thing I remember very well was I liked caramel candy, but it gets sticky. So I wrote to this company in Hamilton, Ontario. See, I said, I don't want any money. I just want to offer you the suggestion. And I said, why don't you dip the caramels in hard chocolate so they won't stick? And also, they might taste better and easier to handle. Oh, man, the number of caramel boxes I got back. It was wonderful, you see. And I became the little inventor of the neighborhood, and I gave all this stuff away. But so there was an inventive bent that I can't explain. Maybe it was DNA of some kind that was there. And as a boy now, I would help the fruit man sell his go around door to door. I would do that on Saturdays to make money, and we were always doing something. There was no laziness built into any of us. We were learned use your time very valuably. So all of these things. Oh, the other thing is, I used to write a lot, and I had dreams of writing books, and these were handwritten or on my little typewriter. So I rented, with my newspaper earnings, a post office box. And I've been a hound for mail ever since. I can't wait for the mail to come in here. It's always a grab bag, you know. And the postmaster, he would see me sitting outside on the steps of the post office in Cornwall. And he said, I've never seen anything like it. He said, the mail is going to be sorted in an hour, and you're here waiting for it to be sorted. He said, what is it you want? And I said, well, I'm writing for different things. And he said, he just shook his head. He said, I can't believe that you will sit here until that mail. And sometimes a week would go by and there wouldn't be anything, but I'd be there. So these are little anecdotes that give you an insight into, let's say, what makes me run. And the real story comes when I went to McGill. In that,
your science experience in the high school, what was that like?
I have a poor recollection of it. The thing I remember most in the Cornwall Collegiate Institute, being under sort of British rule then, was the following. You won't believe this. Mandatory physical exercise. Mm. And do you know what it consisted on? You'd have to wear Scottish kilts and march around the grounds in the snow for physical exercise. You nearly freeze to death. I mean, I'm telling you, if you didn't have warm underwear on, you're in trouble. And you know, you're walking in there with the damn kilts. And worse yet, the next door man to us was the head bagpiper for the whole British people. And he'd practice that damn bagpipe until 2 or 3 in the morning. So I don't remember much in the way of scientists. I think I learned more among our home discussions than we did at high school at that time.
You said you had an older brother who was a chemist, started as a chemist for Courtauld.
He was a chemical engineer.
Okay.
Nicholas, Nick. He's still alive. He was the first member of the family to become a professional. And when he graduated in 1932 or early 33, he received the Governor General's Medal as the best grade in chemical engineering throughout Canada. But there were no jobs. And NI, the only job he could get, even with those credentials, to show you what a depression was, that he got a job at the Howard Smith Paper Mill Company in Cornwall, relining bricks in the kilns that they used, the digesters and so forth. And he, 25 cents an hour, gold medalist for the whole of Canada. And I remember NI coming home and clearing his throat from the dust and blood coming out of his throat. Now, I answered the telephone when a call came in from Mr. Linnet, who was then president of Courtauld's Canada. It was British control. They made rayon and cellophane, big operation. And Mr. Linnet said, I need to talk to your brother. And I said, well, he's working, but I'll be glad to give him the message. Now, Mr. Linnet called Queen's University, where NI got his degree, and said, look, our chief chemist is dying from cancer, and we need to find an outstanding chemical engineer to replace him promptly. And they said, well, what are you talking about? NI Batista in your own hometown is the best that we could possibly recommend. So my brother interviewed with Mr. Linnet promptly, and he got the job. But the job started at $6,000 a year. I mean, that was manna from heaven in 1933, and that's what prompted him to get a car. Of course, in those days, you could get a car pretty cheaply. So then he did such a good job, and incidentally, show you the Batista trait. He hired me to do analytical lab work on a shift basis, analyzing the baths that precipitated the rayon and the horrible fumes and so forth. But because he grew into president of the company quite rapidly, and then became chairman and president. But in order that no one would ever accuse him of giving me special favors, because he was president, he had the lab manager see that I washed the floors and did all the dirty work, so the other people knew that there was no favoritism there. And I had to do it.
You've already touched on the depression, and I was going to ask about the effect on your family. You were 12 years old in 1929 when the depression came. And yet you went on to McGill.
In the Depression.
In the Depression.
Well, the real thing that did it was my brother getting this income. Mm-hmm. That made all the difference in the world.
Had he gone to McGill?
No, he went. He got his degree at Queen's University on a Knights of Columbus scholarship because of his very high grades in high school. Yes.
Why did you select McGill?
Well, mainly because at the time I had dreams of maybe becoming a physician, and McGill had. It's got a good reputation and everything, but boy, it's medical, you know, just tremendous reputation throughout the world. And that was the main reason.
What were your experiences like there? And I'm assuming your degree was finally in chemistry, is that correct?
A B.S. honors degree, a first class honors degree in chemistry, yes.
When did you give up your medical hopes and switch to chemistry?
Well, Arthur made it very clear he was going to go to McGill, and he did. We lived together while he was at McGill and before I graduated, and I'm glad I did that because he's proven to be far better than I could ever be as a surgeon.
What was it like at McGill?
Oh, wonderful. But I had some...
First time you were away from home?
Yes, first time I was away from home. But now I'm going to tell you some interesting stories about McGill. For some reason, I have written quotations. I've written over 70,000 original epigrams. Two of the books are published. But while I was a student at McGill, I was trying to write unusual little epigrams for the Saturday Evening Post. And the motivation was one thing only. It was had nothing to do with self-aggrandizement. It had to do with earning money to eat. And I, at the time, was sending these handwritten quotations to an editor called Peggy Doust of the Saturday Evening Post. And all of a sudden, they began to like them. I remember quite well, you know. I admire tombstones because at least they always say something good about a man who's down. They bought so many of them. And they would send me $10 for each one sentence. Mm. Now, with $10... I could have a full course meal at the Clover Leaf Inn just around Strathcona Hall. I could have, for 25 cents in those days, a full course meal including some kind of English dessert. Maybe it was bread pudding or something. But it was a full course meal. So with one quotation, I could eat a full course meal instead of sharing a can of beans with Arthur. That was our normal meal. One can of Campbell's pork and beans heated on a little oven in our room, and we split it. And that was our meal for years. That's all we could afford. So Peggy Doust kept buying them. Gosh, they used some of my most widely quoted quotoons. And, of course, the Reader's Digest now, almost every other month, is carrying my quotable quotes from my writing. And so I sent in a quotation. Remember now, this is the 30s. And I said, if you must cry over spilt milk, condense it. She bought it. But then she wrote back, because for some reason... I thought using the byline, Orlando Aloysius Batista, would catch a person's eye, at least, even if I didn't sell it. So she said, Mr. Batista, we have a suggestion. She said, do you mind us suggesting that you reduce your byline, because your byline on this quote is bigger than the quote? So... from that day, I assumed the O.A. Batista byline, and I have kept it ever since. And I had a very interesting experience with Peggy Dowse. I never smoked, but I would have a pipe packed with cotton when I studied, and I would just use it as a chewing thing or some divergence. And I also would buy apples, and with a little pen knife or carving knife, I would remove the peelings and then slice the apple and eat it while I was studying or working. So I get a note back from Peggy Dowse, and she said, "We appreciate your enthusiasm for contributing to the Saturday Evening Post, but in your last batch of post quotes, we found the enclosed penknife, and we're returning it to you, thinking that this may be a little more aggressive than you want it to be." Now, McGill University, two or three very, very important things. Just like Miss Tobin, a Dr. Thompson was dean of literature, and he liked to give classes to the first line students coming into the university, because you had to pass his exam to qualify. He was a very distinguished man, and gosh, I remember he would relate Shakespeare and tears would come down his eyes. He's that, just like Miss Tobin. So, gee, I thought I was a pretty good writer, but he would always give me a C minus, and I couldn't understand it. And so one day after class, he said, "Batista, I want to talk to you." I didn't know what the heck it was. And he said, "I read the Saturday Evening Post last week, and I saw an epigram in there, byline, by Orlando Aloysius Batista. Now," he said, "with a personal name like that, it must be you. You can't have two of those." And I said, "Yes, it is." He said, "My God." He said, "I've been trying to sell stuff to the Saturday Evening Post for 30 years. I've never had a bite." I got an absolute A-plus on everything I wrote from there on. See? But he couldn't believe. He saw these things and said, "Oh, that's somebody else. Can't be this guy that I'm giving C-minuses to," you see. Now, the other professor is Professor Hatcher, who influenced my career tremendously. One of the nice things about McGill that I remember was that those of us who were taking the honors course in chemistry, there were five of us in the class, one professor to five students. Can you imagine that? Oh. So, Professor Hatcher befriended me in many ways. He was an unusual, I don't think he's alive, but he was unusual. He told me when I graduated, he said, "You know," he said, "I'll tell you a little secret now that you're graduated." He said, "I never read final exam papers." He says, "What I do is I take them," of course, there's only five students, and he said, "at the end of the year in the final exams, I take these home," and he said, "there's a landing on my stairway, and I throw them over my shoulder, and then I walk down, and I pick one up at a time, and I see, who's this fella? Thompson." He thinks of his whole year with Thompson, and he marks it. Comes the Batista. "Oh, but what's this fella got? What's his potential? What's motivating him?" And that's why he doesn't even read the exam. He said, "That's unimportant." He looks for the substance over the whole year, how that person interfaced with him, you see. And I didn't know that, and I was happy to say that maybe for other reasons that he gave me the highest graduation mark. And I think the reason he did was a notice came out in late 1939 with the war in Britain. It was either imminent, but I think Hitler already was bombing England. And the Canadian government asked all the professors to get ideas. And one idea they wanted was the Germans had huge nitroglycerin plants in Germany. And they wanted somebody to figure out a way through their own sabotage that they could put a chemical in these nitroglycerin plants so the nitroglycerin wouldn't come to the top, and then it'd be useless, because what they would do, they would react nitric acid with glycerin, and the nitroglycerin would come to the top. They could siphon that off and use it for... So Professor Hatcher, you know, mentioned this to the class, and, gee, I got an idea. And I said, and I went in the lab and I worked it, and I said, now ferric chloride will interact with glycerin in such a way that maybe it'll prevent the nitroglycerin from separating. And I did laboratory experiments, proved it, gave it to Professor Hatcher as a formal, crudely typewritten report. I think I have a copy of it somewhere. And golly, he came in and verified. Let me show, look, the nitroglycerin isn't separating, whereas if I don't add ferric chloride, it does. Well, he was so impressed that I did it on my own initiative, following up his exposure to the idea, that he sent it on to the secret war people in Ottawa, and I got a letter of commendation back shortly after I graduated, acknowledging that they considered this a very important possible solution to the problem. But he did that for me. But the most important thing, and now I come to something I have dreamed of since I first thought of it, but it could be very controversial. When I was taking physics under Dr. Norman Shaw, professor of physics at McGill, again a very small class, there are only four particles known in nuclear physics: the electron, the positron, the alpha particle, and the neutron. Positron, electron, neutron, and the alpha particle. And if anybody thought there was anything more than that, it was blasphemous. That's what the big wheels say, and you believe it. It's like the Pope. Well, I don't believe in infallibility in anybody, frankly, unless it's tested. So it suddenly occurred to me, now why is it that you can get positrons and electrons, and if the two come together, you get a neutral particle, and here you have an alpha particle, which is really a minimum of four hydrogen atoms, heavier. Why should that be the only four particles in the structure of the universe? And this is before I even knew about the Big Bang and everything. So I created a particle which I called the infinitron, which was the first condensation of all the matter in the universe into one incredibly massive particle. And it was the explosion of the infinitron that led to all the other particles, including today, there are hundreds of new particles all the time being found, because they're finding that any particle that is bigger than an electron or a positron can be broken down into smaller particles. So I wrote a little paper. I got so excited. I couldn't sleep. I said, this thing is incredible. So I wrote this little paper up, calling it The Theory of Infinitrons, and pointed out that I predicted that they will find thousands of subparticles in the whole spectrum of nuclear physics, not just four. Well, I got so excited. So I went to see Professor Norman Shaw, the head of physics, and I explained to him what I was saying. And he was smoking his pipe, and he said, now, Batista, you're tired. you ought to get a little rest, he said. He said, all I can warn you is that what you're saying is a lot of gibberish, and that if you should ever put that down on your exam, you'll never graduate from McGill. So, with tears in my eyes, I had a meeting with Professor Hatcher. And he said to me, he said, now look, he said, try to understand Professor Shaw. He believes what his peers publish. He believes it with all the faith that some Catholics will believe what the Pope says. And he said, you're here, a little student at McGill University, still not wet behind the ears, and you're telling a head of our physics department that what he's believing is all hogwash. And he said, that doesn't go over well from a student. So he said, try to be kind to Professor Shaw and sleep on this. But he said, don't give it up. Stick with it. Write it up. Record it in some way. So I did. And I got it copyrighted just for the official record. But as I follow the physics environment today, it's exactly what was written in that little handwritten piece of paper in 1938 at McGill University, or 39. But this is what I have found throughout my career. I'm going to tell you about true incidents that occurred on a one-to-one basis that, in retrospect, are horrible manifestations of the human nature to reject anything new. This is why the world is in the state it is. It won't listen to counter arguments. That's not science. And it's not science if you're a professor of physics and are just as blind to any new radical idea as you would be to a religious radical change. The same philosophy. It's ingrained somehow, maybe back to the DNA in human beings. There's most human beings, not all. There's some that are very open-minded. But those are experiences at McGill that I'll never forget. It was a wonderful school with such close relationship with your professors. My gosh, Jim, I served as a full adjunct professor at UTA here in Arlington to start a microcrystal polymer science. And I gave a credit course on colloidal polymer science. And I couldn't take it after 2 years. They thought all my ideas.
What was your first assignment at American Viscose, Marcus?
My first assignment at American Viscose of any consequence was, even though I was a Canadian citizen when the war broke out, of course, I was up for the draft. And because I had training in polymer science, Dr. Venable, dear man, and of course he just didn't do it for me, but I became part of the substitute rubber program, and I would get deferred. However, every 6 months I'd have to go up for a physical and go through everything, wait for Washington, don't know what. I sometimes wish it would have been better to go in and not have for 5 years or whatever it was the uncertainty of it. But I did some good work there, I think, and developed a rubber substitute made from a viscose modification, but it never got into commercialization because the butyl rubbers replaced it and more effective. And so I was involved in war-related projects until the end of the war, and then I got married in late August 25th, 1945, and the war had just petered out then, and the draft was stopped. And then I started to create on my own inventions. And while at American Viscose, and FMC bought them out in 1963, over 65 U.S. patents of mine in my name were owned by American Viscose and FMC. And out of those, two patents have been of the greatest commercial success. But I was doing basic research under Wayne Sisson on the morphology and the structure of celluloses. Academic, very, very highly sophisticated. Some of the work we did be the equivalent of 3 or 4 PhDs easily. And then by accident, my whole career gelled in 1955.
Okay, I'm looking at some of these things in a chronological fashion, and I have some of your patents, but it was obvious you were doing some of your very early work in cellulose.
Yes.
Some aspects of cellulose chemistry. There was a patent on the extrusion molding of viscose products.
Yes.
I was curious about that. That was
well, the whole idea there had to do with extruding viscose in such a way that you could slice the tube and wash it and make a rubber gasket for mason jars in replacement for rubber. I believe that's what that referred to.
A novel yarn.
Novel yarns.
That was 1949.
Oh, they were yarns that were, as I recall, extruded in such a way that a gas came off as the fiber was formed to create millions of little holes, so the fiber would be very fluffy and light and very warm to wear.
During this period of time, up until the event we want to talk about in, I believe you said 1955, 56, had you been taking any courses? I mean, you were really working in polymer chemistry.
No, other than being a very devotee of the American Chemical Society, attending. That's one good thing. American Viscose is very good and very generous in letting us go to all of the 6 month meetings, and that way I kept up. But I began to publish papers, and my first significant paper was a paper called The Level Off Degree of Polymerization of Cellulose, and that is still used today a great deal throughout the world. I think that was co-authored with two or three other people, however. But it was an idea of mine to measure the molecular weight of cellulose crystals.
You said that you started doing inventions on your own. How did your supervisors look to this? I'm sure they were giving you assignments, but you were still doing other things as well?
That's correct. And I would work Saturdays and Sundays, and the inventions that were created up to 1955 were good, but they were They were little addenda improvements. None of them really became worldwide commercial successes. An accidental, absolutely accidental discovery in 1955 changed my whole course of activity. And I think that's a story that should be told, because it's a fascinating story. And again, wonderful people came to my rescue, or these things would never have flourished. Now, in 1955, our great competitor, the DuPont Company, introduced nylon in tire cord. American Viscose at that time was selling around $250 million to $300 million worth of rayon and tire cord. Because rayon, because of the smaller crystals than cotton, could flex more in a tire, so you would get 25,000 miles instead of 10 or 15. So it replaced cotton completely. So for a good many years, American Viscose had a complete corner on the rayon tire cord market. Announcement came out in early 1955 by DuPont that they were going to introduce nylon tire cord. Well, the magic name nylon at that time had our management. Here was a $300 million investment at risk. So Dr. Venable sent out a little note, said, "Can anybody come up with some idea that might help us be more competitive with the new threat from nylon?" Now, here's where basic research is so important. And I learned most of this at the knee of Wayne Sisson and Sidney Coppig, both of whom have passed away. Unselfish people. So for many years, Wayne Sisson was an X-ray expert on cellulose structure, and so was Dr. Coppig. And under their tutorship, I learned the state-of-the-art of the morphology of all cellulose. Dr. Venable provided the world, it became the world's most famous research center for fine morphology of cellulose under Dr. Sisson, who was a world-renowned X-ray expert. So, I was sitting reading this memo from Dr. Venable to all of the staff, and gee, I had a little cubbyhole of an office looking out on the smoke-filled Marcus Hook dust, and I said to myself, golly, from the fundamental studies, I knew that nylon tire cord had much smaller crystals and perfect crystals than rayon. And therefore, that would be the more hinges between the crystals in the continuity of the molecules, the greater the flex life. And that's the only reason that nylon tire cord is on every big airplane today. Rayon is out. Because of its flexibility and the ability to absorb impact. So the threat was a real one, and it ultimately replaced rayon, really, in tire cord. But the idea that I got sitting there eating my little sandwich at lunch and looking at the sky suddenly occurred to me, but it came back from my fundamental studies with Dr. Sisson, because I learned through electron microscopy and X-ray, low-angle X-ray scattering especially, exactly what the morphology of cellulose crystals, wood pulp, rayon, cellophane. So I said, we're going to try this. I had an assistant, Pat Smith, a little hunchback girl. I hired her just because she was a hunchback, but a wonderful person. And I got all excited, and I said, "Pat," right after lunch, I said, "I want you to do an experiment for me that might help us make a rayon that would be more competitive with DuPont. And I said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to take what I call a level off DP rayon, or it could be wood pulp, but I told her rayon, which we had been working on for 10 years. And I said, now, what I want you to do is put this in a wearing blender with water. And I just picked out of the sky, I want you to use 5% solids, and I want you to run the wearing blender for a long time intermittently so you don't burn the motor out. And then after a total of a half an hour, what I predict, and oh, did I learn a lesson from this, never predict in science. Boy, that's one way of putting your head in the fan. But it has some benefits too. And I said, what's going to happen is that after the sharp blades are going to cause little slivers of crystals to break away from the rayon crystal, and they will be so small, they'll be in Brownian motion, and they will float to the top and not settle. Those particles that weren't broken down, the crystals, will settle like sand, they're water insoluble, and will siphon off the supernatant, concentrate it, and seed it into the viscose spinning tire cord, and let the seeds create smaller crystals in the final product. What we need to do is make smaller crystals with more hinges. That's the key. So Pat performed the experiment. And she came back to me and she said, Dr. Batista, what you told me didn't happen. All I have is this bunch of junk. So shall I throw it down the sink and repeat it? Now, what Pat saw and showed me was something that nobody in the history of the universe looked on before. And I turned to Pat and I said, Pat, you and I are looking on a phenomenon that nobody in the history of the universe could ever have seen before. What a thrill. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I said, we are looking at pure cellulose without a calorie and a carload that looks like Crisco, smooth as butter, and therefore edible as butter. We have the basis here of opening a food revolution to reduce cholesterol and control overweight. So Pat did not have to repeat the experiment, although of course millions of pounds. So I got so excited about what I dreamed could occur because of this phenomenon. Polymer chemistry missed it completely because it's the antithesis of being a good polymer scientist. You want to make long molecules with stronger, tougher. Here, we're degrading molecules down to submicron crystals that have no physical strength per se, but they have colloidal properties because they're not water soluble that are unique. So, again, Herschel Cudd, who became a vice president at Amoco, another great person, I don't think he's alive now. My boss was a Dr. Lothrop, who was directing the program on the tire cord. So, I guess I've always been a bit of a maverick. So I would come into the lab on evenings and weekends, and I would make up, in the analytical lab, cheesecake with 60% reduced calories, whipped cream with 60% reduced calories, custards, all kinds of things. But that had nothing to do with solving the tire cord problem. Nobody has ever tested that idea. yet, and neither did I. But I believe it's still as sound as when I wrote them. And Dr. Lothrop got mad. And he went to Dr. Cudd, and he said, I want to fire the Batista. He's using the analytical lab to cook cheesecakes and whipped cream, and he's not working on the problem that we're all supposed to be working on. And he said he comes in here evenings and weekends working very hard, but not on the problem that he's supposed to be working on. So Herschel Cudd said, now wait a minute. Are you telling me that this young man is coming in here evenings and weekends on his own initiative pursuing something he believes in? Yes. Okay. I will take him away from your jurisdiction. I will give him a small laboratory with one technician, and he will report to me, and he can do whatever the hell he wants with what he's interested in. Otherwise, I'd have been fired. Now, out of that, and I'm writing the second edition of Microcrystal Polymer Science. That was printed by McGraw-Hill in 1975. It's the only book on this subject in the world. Polymer chemists considered that blasphemous, that you should degrade polymers instead of improving them. But they missed the point because they're blind. What we're doing is we're opening up a whole new world of colloidal polymer science that is completely separate and independent in commercial use from fibers or films. Okay, they're coming around though. Now, I did a literature search since this book was published, and there's over 4,000 articles published in the literature on microcrystalline cellulose alone. My, this book is going to be about five times that thick. All over the world. That's where everybody reads good science. Now, to date, microcrystalline cellulose used in foods and pharmaceuticals is approaching the 1 billion pound market worldwide. FMC has averaged $2 a pound on 1 billion pounds worldwide. They licensed the whole my patents to Asahi. Every pound was sold under the patent in my name, and I insisted that Pat Smith be on it. That patent number was on every package and every drum around the world. It is in greater demand today than it ever has been since that accidental discovery. Now, the interesting thing is, Jim, that Dr. Lothrop, who was younger than me, the only reason he has a job today is that he is manager of quality control for the biggest plant in the world to make the product that he wanted to fire before. Otherwise, he'd be out of a job. That's how the whole wheel of fortune turns. Isn't that fascinating?
Absolutely.
Yeah, he meant well. He wanted to do his job. He was doing what he thought he had to do. But Dr. Cudd really saved the whole product.
Now, I think the patent, at least what I note here, shows the patent was 1962.
It took that long to get it from the original. Yes. I think that was the one with me and Pat Smith. It was the basic patent.
Check it quickly, but I think that's correct.
It's 2,900,000 and something, I believe.
Oh, no, that's a... I'm sorry, the 1962 was a paper that...
Oh, that was the level off DP paper, yes.
All right.
I can get that for you here quickly.
That's 2978446.
Yeah, that's the one
Number
over 800 million pounds sold.
Now, who was Pat Smith?
Pat Smith was the little hunchback girl.
Okay.
And I insisted, she didn't invent it, but she was implemental, and I insisted that she be a coal inventor. I don't think she's living today. I have never heard anything in a long time from her.
Where did the trade name Avicel come from?
Now, that, all of the trade names, Avicel, Avatine, were originated by me. The trademark of American Viscose was Avisco, and they had about 150 trademarks with the AVI. So I just came out and said, well, you'll get your trademark, and boy, has it ever been valuable. So Avicel, Avi Amylose, Avi Amid, Avi Esters, I created at that time, yes.
How soon after this did you start looking at other polymers for the same process? Because, as you just said, you started with cellulose, but there was...
Well, in 1963, FMC Corporation bought out American Viscose. And they closed down the Marcus Hook Research Center, and they transferred only 2 out of 75 scientists that they let go to Princeton, their central research department. Dr. Cruz, who has since died, a very close friend of mine and a great contributor to the whole field of microcrystal polymers, and I were transferred to Princeton. And at Princeton, they appointed me Assistant Director of Chemical Research, mainly, I guess, a little bit in recognition of the success of my inventions. But the at Princeton, my main responsibility first, no, I think I was appointed Assistant Director a little later. I forget the title I had, but I was sort of a freelancer. And of course, I had been telling FMC and American Viscose, look, we have already demonstrated that any crystalline polymer can be adapted to what we did with cellulose, so amylose starch, nylons, polyesters, polyolefins. Now, those, as a matter of fact, this phone call from Toronto that I'll be returning this afternoon is from head of Microtech, who has licensed all the other microcrystals. And along the way, FMC, I begged them, since they weren't going to do anything with these microcrystals, would they please return the rights of my patents to me? And I said, if necessary, I'll be glad to pay a fee. I thought they would say, well, we're not going to use them, you can have them. Mm-hmm. Boy, I had to pay $10,000 and go through so much legal paperwork. But they charged me $10,000 to give me my own patents that they had no intention. They made so much money from Avicel, they didn't want to dilute that effort, you see. And they didn't know what I knew post-FMC about the potential. Well, these will all be treated in depth in the new treatise, and Microtech Industries hopes to have a big plant on stream to produce the amylose, the nylon, and the polyesters. And the biodegradability release that I think you have a copy, where we take polyester pop bottles, and you should see what we can do with this. It's much more important than Avicel, because it opens up a whole world of colloidal polymer chemistry using polyester and nylon, which melt. We can now take, Jim, a fiber board that uses formaldehyde, which is in disrepute. We can take sawdust, okay, and add these microcrystals of polyester from the Coke bottle. I could show you all these samples here. It's just like Crisco in water. No toxic organic solvents. Now, you dry the sawdust and compact it by filtration. Now you have coated. Oh, man, I get so excited when I think of this. These little crystals are 300 angstroms in maximum size. So when you take particle board or fibers or paper that you've coated and you now heat it for a millisecond at the melting point of the polyester crystals, you are mechanically producing the equivalent of a covalent chemical bond homogeneously throughout the plywood. And it's waterproof, and the crystals won't melt. At polyester, you have to go to 255 degrees centigrade. There's the whole new opportunity for microcrystal polymers, with all of them. Not a pound yet has been sold, but it's going to be a big, big business. Experiment for which we were nearly fired. I can tell you stories like this over and over. Why? Gosh, somebody's got to address themselves to this. I think we're losing 90% of the greatest ideas because of the resistance to even consider them viable when they're presented.
That was a very busy time for you in other respects, too.
Yes, I was publishing books, writing books.
Yes,
and
that was one of the things I wanted. You had a book in 57, I think you just mentioned it, How to Enjoy Work. How did that book originate? What was...
This is very interesting. I was writing post quotes for the Saturday Evening Post until it was sold and became a monthly. The editors of Prentice Hall approached me and said, "We've been seeing your byline in the Saturday Evening Post, and we like your little quips. How about writing a book for us about your why you enjoy life so much?" So that was the origin. I think they gave me a $5,000 advance. And I had suggested the title because that's what I feel, how to enjoy work and get more fun out of life. I wish billions of people could learn that. And they can learn it if they would only change their thinking. So Stuart Sloan and George Costello, the editors at Prentice Hall, called me to New York to sign the contract, and they asked me to prepare an outline of what the book would comprise. And while they were there, the hot book, this would have been 59 or 50, a hot book by a Dr. Schindler, How to Live 365 Days a Year, from Minnesota, I think. And that book was going out in carloads all over the country. Carloads! And George Costello said, "Now, we don't know why. We didn't expect this book to catch on. But let me show you here." They showed me a check for $85,000 in royalties to Dr. Schindler for 6 months. But that was even at the very early stages, you see. No, he said, we all said, oh, this book is going to do reasonably well, but we didn't know that one person would tell another. We can't predict it. He said, we have bombed out. All of our experts have bombed out. The ones that they say are going to go good, bomb out. The ones they say, oh, no way, runs off. He said, it's a phenomenon. Anybody could figure out how to do this, they'd pay $1 million for it. So it was a very successful book. But that they invited me to do it, you see. Mm-hmm. And then I think the other book that I did second to that was even more successful, Power to Influence People.
Right, that was
had nothing to do with chemistry, you see. I think there was only four books that I, or three or four, Challenge of Chemistry, Microcrystal Polymer Science, Synthetic Fibers and Paper Making, Mental Drugs.
Yes, I wanted to talk to you about that
okay.
one, too. But before we do, it's still working in this same time period. This is still the late 50s, early 60s. The Fundamentals of High Polymers that you've just mentioned that you're going to be doing the second edition to, did you approach Reinhold or on doing that?
No. Professor Mark recommended to McGraw-Hill that they get me to write this book because he felt this was something of great importance. Now, McGraw-Hill came to me on that. Professor Mark also has recommended me as an author for the revised second edition. And, of course, he was responsible for Wiley's synthetic. See, most of these publishers look to somebody like Dr. Mark to tell them that there's a new science emerging, so they get in on the ground floor. And I'm sure he gets properly paid for it.
I guess I'm actually confusing two things, because that is the microcrystal polymer science, but then
yeah.
you wrote earlier, you had one, the Fundamentals of High Polymers.
Oh, for Reinhold.
Yes.
I forgot all about that. Yeah.
I was.
No, I'm sorry. A fellow by, an editor by the name of Dr. Hawley, who, for Reinhold, who was the, he's not living now, but he wrote the Hawley's Dictionary of Science or something. He approached me to write on that, mainly because of some papers I was publishing at the ACS papers.
Okay.
Yes. Now that is still, I forgot it, I've got maybe one copy only. It's a little outdated because the whole knowledge of polymer science, including my own knowledge, has changed tremendously.
Well, then we get to the Challenge of Chemistry. That's an unusual book, and an interesting book.
Now, this book by Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston, this was initiated by me, and I tried several publishers until Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston editor did it. The reason I did it was, at this stage of my career in 1958 and 59, I was an extremely prolific writer for many magazines, many national magazines, and frankly, my writing brought me in much more income than my American Visco salary. So, but here, I had written so many articles on chemistry for the public, which led to the Grady Award. Which was a complete surprise to me. I don't think any other chemist has been ever received a Grady Award. It's usually editors of big magazines. I came as an absolute surprise. I learned later that Dick Moore, who was chairman, he used to be sort of a right-hand man to Peter Grace. He's retired. I understand it was through his initiative that my nomination was at least prepared. But at this period of my career, I was very active writing, you can see, and I've slowed down a bit since. But I really love chemistry, and I felt that this book could trigger, like Arthur did with Paul de Kruijf, if I could make it readable enough and easy enough, sort of human interest and exciting, that if it got on the shelves of high schools, it could maybe lead a few people into the profession. That was the whole, but I took the initiative on writing this book and getting the contract. I haven't read it in a long time, but I think it's quite readable.
Now, I was looking at it, and it's a very interesting book, especially for that time period.
Yes.
This may be a little aside, but this might be a good point to, for me to ask this question. You commented about all of the things you've written that are non-technical, and I want to come back to that later. Here you're talking about this particular book. You had 4 or 5 written in a 3-year period. How rapidly do you write? I mean, it must come easy to you to accomplish as much writing as you do.
It's a good question. Writing comes in a mood cycle. Sometimes you can sit down and, by God, you can't get a word out. But there's other times it just flows. It's like opening a spigot and then shutting it. But you never know how to do it. You've got to wait for that mood. There's sometimes on a Sunday night I sit down and I can't write a single quotoon. Boy, there are other times they just gush out. You see?
Yeah.
I wish we knew the quantitative answer. That would be a good research project. Believe me. Yeah.
I've had similar experiences.
I'm sure you
not
have.
Not on your level of volume, but similar experiences. The first paragraph is always the toughest one.
It really is.
One other thing before we leave American Viscose and the FMC and get to the FMC period. I think you had a number of different titles while you were with American Viscose, but I wasn't clear what they were or when, what dates they may have changed. I have, for example, that you were Assistant Director of Corporate Research from 61 to 63, which would have been the end of that.
That was when Avicel was, yes. Before that, I was just a research chemist at first, and then I think they made me a senior research chemist before I became assistant director of corporate research. It was sort of something like that.
As you've described it, you sound that, and if I may use the term, you certainly sound like somewhat of a maverick in the typical industrial setting.
Oh, definitely. Oh, definitely. And I tried to be as politically observant to that because if Dr. Cudd hadn't told Dr. Lothrop, "Now, wait a minute, you're telling me this man on his own initiative is doing all this work on his own time, we're not going to fire him." He said, "We don't have anybody that does things like that. You have to kick him in the pants to do things." So if Dr. Cudd hadn't intervened in my behalf, I don't think Avicel would be in the market. Thousands of jobs wouldn't have been created. And the same thing goes for the other important invention that we'll get to, the hemostat. That's even more exciting in that regard. So I'm a great believer in an Italian economist by the name of Pareto. You may know of Pareto's law.
No, I'm afraid I don't.
Now, he was an economist, but I've adapted it as a general law. He said in 1906 in Italy that in the field of economics, boy, is he right? He said, over a period of 50 years or a lifetime, 3 to 6 critical events occur that determine in advance the future of your life. Pareto's law. See, cud, that was a Pareto action. The accidental thing of coming here and giving a lecture in Texas was an accidental, unpredictable event, and a very simple one, but it changed certainly my whole life completely. So Pareto's law said that in your lifetime and mine, I'm saying this, he said it for economics, but I believe it's a more universal law than he thought. But the principle is what he said. 3 to 6 events. Who your parents were. You and I didn't ask to be born. That's a critical event. Nobody got our permission in advance. And yet, the DNA that was formed there is a very Pareto event. Who you marry. What job you take. And your whole outlook on life. But these events occur unexpectedly, uncontrollably. The important thing is to recognize them and do something about them. Most people ignore Pareto events, and therefore they either run into very serious trouble financially or they're failures because they're on the wrong track. To me, the most valuable quality that anybody can discipline themselves is this. For God's sakes, don't think you know it all and keep an open mind when others say something that rubs you wrong. They might be absolutely right. Now, I want to interject here something that has made my institute unique. When I hire a person, if that person in the interview says the first thing, what are my fringe benefits? How much money am I going to... The interview stops. If the person says to me, oh, that's exciting. Tell me more what you're doing here. This is so exciting. He's got a chance. I have a contract, deliberately, with every employee, whether they're technicians or professionals, or secretaries. And I don't think this exists anywhere else in this planet. The contract says, and it goes back to my comment to Pat Smith. I told her, and she believed me, what she was going to get, and I was wrong. So to discipline myself, I tell these people, look, if I'm ever foolish enough to tell you ahead of time what you're going to get when I suggest something, and you can experimentally prove me wrong, I will handwrite you a $1,000 bonus check within 5 minutes. Where in the world will you find that? Now, I did that deliberately to let these people know that they shouldn't look on me as being infallible and they shouldn't be afraid to ask for their $1,000. Now, Pat, I learned my lesson with Pat. I haven't had to give $1,000 yet, but I will if necessary.
Fascinating. Very fascinating. Let me just review a few other things that caught my eye in looking at your... Well, there was one thing that I did want to... That one book is the Mental Drugs book, which was also published in 1960. So there was another one in that time period. It's on my other page. I was very fascinated by that book.
Pardon?
I was very fascinated by that book and your original premise back in 1960.
Yes.
And because I've had, through my own personal experience, some, without any scientific basis, similar feelings about what you've discussed in there.
What was the origin of that book? That's pretty far afield from some of the other things that you were doing at the time.
The origin of that book arose from my being a maverick, questioning the efficacy of the couch to cure a chemical error in the body. And I felt that this was almost a travesty of that profession in charging very high fees for rather ineffective treatment. I believe, and have since I was a young man, that the human being is a chemical factory. We are what our chemistry makes us. And for me to talk to you, Jim, requires at least 100,000 chemical reactions in the neurons in my brain. Now, I mean, this is, most people don't know this. So they grab on every little thing. I have a psychologist as a tenant in my building, Dr. Kamichek. She's got a steady stream at $100 an hour going in to just talk to her. Husbands and wives, workmen, all kinds of people. She's hired by the collider here to interview every employee for stability and honesty before they hire. She's making a fortune. But it isn't a quantitative, see? So I said, look, it's time that somebody, oh, the other thing was that I felt so sorry having visited a mental institution to see way back in those years people chained to their beds and in, oh, the criminal, the shock waves they would give them. These people would go into convulsions. And that really said, now, wait a minute. It's time to say that chemistry is important. Now, let me tell you the truth on this. This is what gets me so mad. Shilton is a very, very responsible publisher up in the Philadelphia area. Very. They are big publishers on the motor books. I mean, that's what the. Now, when that book appeared, it started to get a lot of reviews. Now, 17,000 psychologists and psychiatrists, hundreds of them, wrote into Shilton and said that if you publish a second edition of that book, we will never buy another Shilton book. That's how prejudiced they were. And it was never reprinted. Shilton just couldn't take the risk. But if you read that today, it's exactly what these same people are doing. They're subscribing drugs. And our mental institutions are pretty empty only because of chemistry. But you won't read that in the newspaper. No way. But it shows you how prejudiced religions, scientists alike, and politicians, anything that's a threat to their security, boy, they just raise their fur. And the publisher has to bow to it because he depends on selling the books for his living. That's what happened there.
You approached them on that book, then?
I was what?
You approached them on that book.
Yes,
on that
book. Yes. And a lot of other publishers turned the offer down.
There was one other thing also in this time period. Where was it? It had to do with something with tobacco. Oh, here we are. Reconstituted tobacco products. It's a patent that you had.
To the tobacco.
Reconstituted tobacco products.
Oh. Yeah, that never got off the ground. That was a question of Yeah, it's still a good idea. What we were talking about there was to take hydroxypropyl methyl cellulose as a binder and formulate it into a tobacco leaf, but in the hydroxypropyl methyl cellulose, we would put the level of nicotine. You know, it isn't nicotine that causes lung cancer. It's the benzpyrenes and the other carcinogens. So the idea was to make a cigarette or a pipe tobacco that would eliminate the benzpyrenes and the smoking, but permit the kick of the nicotine to get in. But nothing's ever done on that.
There are. I have noticed that there are attempts to do that kind of thing.
There are attempts to do that. As a matter of fact, one of the latest approaches I have, which sort of supersedes that, I've never smoked in my life. I did have a pipe with batten in it, but I never smoked tobacco. I did once. As a little boy, the only time I ever got a spanking was... A group of other little boys and I made some corn silk cigarettes. I bet I was only seven. And we got under the veranda of our little home. And my father was coming home to work, from work. And he saw smoke coming out from under the house, and he thought the house was ready to burn down. Well, when he extracted me and several others, I got a patty, I'm telling you. And I've never touched tobacco or corn silk ever since. So
so 1963, then you moved to Princeton.
Yes. And we lived in Bucks County, and I drove to Princeton.
Okay, so you didn't change your residence then, you commuted?
Oh, yeah, well, no, we sold our house in Drexel Hill. Oh, yes. We had a lovely home in Drexel Hill. We enjoyed Bucks County very much.
I noticed that there are a number of patents which came out at that time which showed the application of microcrystalline cellulose to pharmaceutical preparations and cosmetics and foods and so on. How rapidly did the research effort expand on this?
Slowly. The fundamental discovery was 1955. And here again, a Pareto event. Nobody supported that product. But Dr. Reichel, the biggest stockholder of American Viscose, had a single son. And his son, Frank, went to Yale and got a PhD in organic chemistry. And he told his son, only son, to go around the company and talk to anybody he wanted to in research, to keep his eye open for anything new that he might get a handle on to help his career. Well, Frank spent a few hours with me and told his father. He said, "You've got to see what's going on here. This stuff is terrific." Dr. Reichel and Frank met with me, and I showed him. So what happened was, Dr. Frank H. Reichel is director of the Avicel Department, and Dr. Batista is reporting to Dr. Reichel. Frank rode the crest of Avicel, took over his father's job as chairman and president of American Viscose on the success of Avicel. I never got a penny. The Reichels were so cheap. I shouldn't say cheap. They were so parsimonious that if Frank Reichel would take me to lunch in Chester back in those days, It was 1 penny for 5 minutes on the parking meter. He would say, well, look, Landy, I think we can have lunch in 20 minutes. So he would put 5 nickels in or 5 pennies in or whatever. He wouldn't pay for a whole hour. And he'd watch it, so we got out. Unbelievable. And yet they own the most magnificent marble mansion on Villanova. My God, their kitchen was almost as big as these offices, with marble everywhere. Marble stairways. Oh. Yeah.
What changes occurred when FMC took over?
Fortunately, the man I reported to originally was a man by the name of Sherman K. Reed. Sherman Kennedy Reed. Now, he, like Dr. Cudd, sort of shielded me, and I reported to Sherman Reed. He was director of research of the whole center. He became a vice president director. One of the most wonderful people. He's now retired in Florida, and I don't know how he's doing. But Sherm Reed believed in polymer microcrystals. Most management didn't. And he gave me every possible support. If it wasn't for Sherm Reed's support, he reported to Oscar Johnson at the time, then probably my most significant humanitarian contribution would never have surfaced. Avatine microcrystalline collagen. That was the first product that I started to work on at Princeton, and then followed microcrystalline nylon and polyester and polyolefin. And I directed all that work under Dr. Reed's supervision. Microcrystalline collagen, I was taking the corium of beef hides. You know, if you look at a steer, you've got the hairline, which is leather, and in between is white collagen, and below it is the flesh. The workman's boots, who have the thick boots, are made out of that steer collagen because they don't want to use the valuable leather. So what I wanted to do was produce microcrystalline collagen, there's pictures of it in my book, so that we recover, collagen is not very crystalline, so that the crystals are not nearly as perfect as cellulose or nylon, but they still have integrity. And my idea was to make gelatin, pure gelatin from the collagen, in such a way that the molecular weight of the viscosity of the gelatin would be quite different from the gelatin used in photographic emulsions. And what we did was, we have a patent on it, but it's expired. Patent attorney who joined Alcon when I was there told me, hey, Eastman thought so much of your patent, they decided they could wait 17 years until it was exhausted and then pick it up for nothing. I mean, it's crazy. Anyhow, so I indeed could make a gelatin film, photographic film. We did it. We have photographs taken for the patent, where the sharpness of the image was 20 times greater than ordinary gelatin, because you could make, because of the higher molecular weight, we could make a thinner film, and the thinner the gelatin film, the sharper the exposure. And I had this jar, it's probably in the other room, of this white powder sitting on my desk. On a September morning, Monday morning, and I had cut my cheek fairly deeply with a razor blade in my hurry to get to work. So I happened to walk into my office, and I saw this jar of white material, and the actual sample is in the other office. And the thought occurred to me, here's another Pareto event. Now, I had looked at that stuff 100 times, but because my cheek was still bleeding, I made a connection. So I said, gee, my face is collagen, and that's pure collagen. What's going to happen? I took the Kleenex off and it started to bleed. I took a little of it and put it on, and it didn't sting. That interested me, because the pH is about 6. So I went to the men's room and washed it off with hot water. And my gosh, normally if you do that, the bleeding will restart. But there was a big clot glued to the cut, and it wouldn't bleed. And that's what I told you. I went to Oscar Johnson all excited and said, my gosh, this is far more valuable than gelatin emulsion. This is a life-saving use. And you heard my answer. You said, so what? We're not in the pharmaceutical business. But Sherm Reed backed me up because he controlled my budget. So he's the one that gave me enough money to go to all the pharmaceutical companies and hit a dead end until Mr. Connor, through David Ashburn, who called me, brought me to Texas, or I wouldn't be here. There's a big Pareto event. But more importantly, Avicel was pretty much a business success in terms of making a lot of profit. Avitene, I could show you stories of a 3-year-old kid falling off of a chair and hitting a rocker runner with a spleen bleeding. And my friend Dr. Baxter, who did much of the early clinical work, who was head of Parkland, opened him up, put in some Avitene, sewed him up. Otherwise, he would have had to remove that baby's spleen and he'd be an immunological imbecile for life, probably with a lifespan of 10 to 20 years at the best. More spleens and pancreases and livers have been saved by Avitene. Now listen to this. Dr. Baxter called me one day. He said, I thought you'd like to know this. He said, a man came in here with a 45 bullet wound through his liver, about an inch in diameter. He said, it was just cut through like... And he said, I tried to stop the bleeding with towels and everything. Well, at the time, the only form of Avitene was a powder form. And he didn't know how he could pack it in there. So he got an idea. He cut off the end of a normal plastic syringe, packed it in, and then fed it into the big hole after he had already used 70 pints of blood to try to save the guy's life. He said, Landy, as soon as I plugged it with the syringe, the bleeding stopped. He said, that man's going to live. That liver will heal, the Avitene will be absorbed, and you've just saved another life. I mean, I could tell you dozens and dozens of stories. A young kid on a motorcycle hitting a wire fence in Peoria, Illinois, while I was at Alcon. And they called and said, where can we get this kid's whole innards are bleeding? And the only place at the time that had it was a Chicago hospital, about, I don't know, 30 miles away or something. And boy, they got the state troopers, and they motorcycled a pound or so, or whatever it was, and that kid's life was saved. He would have died from bleeding without question. And the potential of that product has not been Now they're using it at Open Heart Anastomosis to stop bleeding at the connection. They're using it everywhere. I mean, originally it was only approved. It's a prescription drug. Didn't have to be, but they were wise in going through the NDA and the IND. And they just sold the marketing rights, Alcon, to MedChem in Connecticut, who have already doubled the sales to the surgical market, and it's available throughout the world in major hospitals. Now, there again, though, I nearly got fired.
Could we go back? You shared some of that with me yesterday, but could we go back as to the transition from Princeton to Fort Worth and how Avatine led to your moving down here?
Oh, I'd like to tell you that because it's a nice story. It's a very nice story. I told you about Mr. Haight saying we need you down here in 2 weeks and we'll move your family down and all that. And I told you about the Mr. Connors' very clever business dealings. Well, I came down here and was given absolutely royal treatment, and they appointed me vice president for science and technology. They formed this 50-50 company, Avicon. They gave me a lovely office, a secretary, and just everything I wanted. Put me up in the Fort Worth Club for weeks at no expense, you know, brought Helen and Elizabeth Ann down and fussed over them. Just outstandingly courteous people. Something that FMC just blah. Most chemical companies are not very well known for their social courtesy. So I had to live down here, and they would let me go home about every month with full pay. I mean, pay all my expenses. And then Helen came down, and we found the lovely house that we're in, and we love it. It's beautiful. Right in the boulevard here, in the nicest part. And I bought it from a vice president of Alcon who was retiring. So it was a great deal. We paid $73,000 for a corner two-story colonial with 4,400 square feet. Elizabeth Ann has her own apartment there, privacy. And the house is worth over $400,000 today. just, we couldn't ask for a better place to live, and the country club, of course, is a big asset. They treated me very, very well at Alcon. I told you how my salary was treated, and Mr. Connor gave me blocks of Alcon stock. I didn't ask for it. They did it voluntarily. Now, by 1974, early 74, it was clear that all the clinical work, 6,000 operations, we mailed 186 three-ring binders to the FDA as proof of safety and efficacy under the NDA. 186 three, and we paid all these surgeons for doing this work, but it was their reports. So it sailed through the FDA. After all, it's collagen. It's natural, pure collagen, the purest form of collagen known in the world. They use 1,000 gallons of 200 proof alcohol for every pound of Avatine that's made to be sure that there is absolutely no impurities, shock reaction materials left in the collagen, because it's never dissolved, so it's got to be extracted. Fortunately, they only pay 19 cents a gallon because of it. And Avatine, Jim, sells for
$26 million a ton, $13,500 a pound, $32 a gram, which is enough to do an operation. But that's what it is. They sell them. They sell probably a ton or a ton and a half a year.
Is the process very complicated for making it?
Yes. It, because of the FDA purity requirements only. Now, I've developed a gelatin-based hemostat because my original dream was to be able to put Avitene in every glove compartment, every train, every airplane, every home medicine cabinet, because 50% of all mortalities, at least from car accidents, is because of loss of blood before they can get to the hospital. If you had a jar of it, you could stop the bleeding temporarily until, so they wouldn't lose over 50% of their blood and die. And 50% of every death from car accidents in the United States is because of loss of blood before getting to an emergency room.
Again, I'm looking at the period before you came down here. Just trying to get... So you came here in 1971, is that correct?
That's when I moved down, yes.
Because you had, well, in addition to the microcrystalline nylon and amylose, the work that was continuing on that, you have prosthetic devices.
Yes, the collagen material, as far as we're talking now, before I started my own institute, we were making cancerous bone and all kinds of wound and burn dressings out of Avitene, but it never took off because it was too expensive at that price. Now we're doing it using my own gelatin formulas. And gelatin is not collagen, you see. Collagen must have the triple helix. Unlike DNA, it's a double helix. It's a triple helix. And it's quite unreactive as such. But gelatin is... I spent my 17 years working on gelatin. It has got so much potential. Oh, because you can make a contact lens out of it, for example, that has got the refractive index of water. You can't make a contact lens out of gelatin. I mean, out of collagen, it won't dissolve. You've got the triple helix, you see.
You also wrote a whole series of articles for Chemistry. Chemistry Magazine, you wrote a series of articles in 1969.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And also for The Chemist. I was just curious as to how that... So you had, within a two-year period, there was a whole string of articles that you published in Chemistry Magazine. And did you approach them? Did you submit those, or were you approached to do those?
No. Was the ACS publishing Chemistry? I'm trying to think.
I think so.
No. Incidentally, Walter Murphy, do you remember him? Editor of CNE News?
I knew the name. I didn't know him, but I knew the name.
Well,
yes.
Walter Murphy carried, while he was editor, almost every issue carried three of my quotoons. And if you go back to that period, they're all about chemists. Mm. But then when the new editor came in, he thought that wasn't appropriate for, so he dropped it. But Walter did. And Walter sort of took me in hand and got me to write, I don't know whether he was editor of Chemistry or not, but I can't recall. But you see, I was writing these kind of articles for popular magazines, so it was very easy to adapt them.
Maybe Ted Benfey was editor then.
I think he was. Yes.
Okay.
Maybe that's who I was dealing with.
I'll have to ask him because he's, you know, he's at the Beckman Center now.
Oh, he is.
Yes. He's our editor.
Is he really? Yeah. Well, maybe it was he that got me to write those. As I recall, I did it gratis. There was no payment.
We talked about you receiving the Grady Medal in 1973. That's still in the Abacon days. I wanted to ask you about your talk when you received the Grady Medal, because it was then that you talked about the National Olympiad of Science, and I would want to ask you for more information on that and what developed from that.
Boy, you've really asked a good question. It's the real most important priority of my whole life. Anticipating that, I want to read from the book Research for Profit so I won't misread what actually was said or written. When I learned that I was getting the Grady Award, I was overwhelmed because it was the last thing I expected as a chemist. I had attended many Grady Award presentations, so I considered it a very great tribute to have been selected. These awards, ACS awards, are tough things to get, and I've had four or five of them, which is unusual. Anyhow, I gave this lecture in the Fairmont in Dallas. That's where the meeting was held in April 73. And it was very well attended. And among the audience was Harold Urey, because he would always go around and sit in things. Great person. I got the idea, coming back to Fort Worth on a plane, either New York or Philadelphia, because I was saying, what am I going to talk about at the Grady Award, you see? Now, this idea came to me at 37,000 feet because I was pushing myself to pick something that would be unusual. And very briefly, what happened, Jim, the following headline sort of went by my brain. The thought was, look, we have Olympiads of sports. We spend hundreds of millions of dollars on it. There's nothing wrong with them. I'm all for it. But what we need is something more than just pleasurable. So the thought occurred to me, if we could have Olympiads of brain power, not just physical power, but the brain is the most valuable asset on this planet, and it's being completely neglected by leisure activities. So I said, wouldn't it be wonderful? And the dream was this, that if we could have, the details would have to be worked out, but let's say it paralleled sports, maybe every 4 years, and we would bring together competition for brain power in each field of discipline and reward the winners by giving them, if they want it, an institute like mine with a low budget and complete freedom. I have estimated that for 1 hour or maybe 1 hour and a half of the budget of the United States of America, I'm talking 24 hours a day, that comes to about $300 million. $300 million dollars. With that, you could fund anywhere in the world 1,000 institutes like mine, patterned on this philosophy. And out of that, I dreamed, would come so many new products, new GMs and new Silicon Valleys, unlimited, that the dream is that we could create jobs with a paycheck for every human being on this planet, whether they're in Africa or India or Fort Worth, so that they would have the dignity of earning, like my father, the great dignity of earning a check, paying his taxes, feeding his children, but without begging for it, earning it. And I said, and I still say, until that is reached, and it may be thousands of years away, you will never have peace on this planet. All the religion in the world, all the science in the world, will not correct the fundamental defect of the human race. They're not using their heads to take care of their bodies or livelihood. There's no reason why this can't occur. I've seen what happened with Avicel, a simple little invention. Not very important, but it did provide thousands of jobs. So every able-bodied person could earn a paycheck and pay his taxes. We wouldn't have deficits. We wouldn't have all this damn political grindstoning. But the world would be a much happier place. And we would have enough money to take care of the sick over and above it. But now we've got billions of people who are lucky to make 20 cents a day under extremely severe control. But that's thousands of years away. Anyhow, I have spent... Oh, after my talk, Harold Urey came up to me, and incidentally, he had spent the prior evening visiting with a cocktail or so with Helen and me and Elizabeth Ann, and we loved the man. He was such a wonderful person. The award lecture was a plea to create World Olympiads of Knowledge. These were projected as cerebral competitions to prove the overpowering efficacy of brain power versus brawn power. To solve the problems besetting mankind, the late Nobel laureate Harold C. Urey extended this inspiring challenge to me after hearing my Grady Award lecture. Here is his quote: "Don't let anyone or anything ever stop you from carrying the torch to create the magnificent dream of your Grady lecture." Later, an equally prominent peer, Professor Herman Mark, Dean of Polymer Chemistry Worldwide, wrote this, and I have this in letter form. "A few days ago, I received the booklet on the Olympiad of Knowledge. What a beautiful document and what an excellent idea. What you are doing now goes far beyond into a new dimension for the well-being and benefit of mankind. There can be no doubt in my mind that your ideas will prevail, and I am entirely at your disposal if you feel that I can be of any help." Now, that letter is in my formal file. These are two people who saw what I was trying to communicate. Most didn't. Now, I have made a substantial income from my institute. a couple of years, my consulting rewards are over $700,000. Alone, with two people. People were paying me a minimum consulting fee of $10,000 a month under contract for 3 years with royalties on products. It has decreased now because of the depression, but I still have many clients. Now, what I have done is I publish Knowledge Magazine. I think you may have a copy.
No, we don't. I wanted...
I'd sure want you to have a copy.
Yes, I'd like to...
I'd like to put you on our subscription list so that... But anyhow, I've spent several hundred thousand dollars of my consulting income since 1976. I have a registered trademark on the magazine. I have to write it mostly. We get such miserable submissions that, they don't have the quality. And it's normally published four times a year. Now, here's the sad state of affairs. I think you have a copy of that. That was my dream that didn't come true. That was my hope to create in 1990 the first crude Olympiad of Knowledge. And it's a whole application form and it tells all about it. All right. Now here's what happened. The reason I proceeded was, you probably heard of W. Clement Stone.
Mm-hmm.
He is so taken by this that he has come here to this institute three times. He's about 89 or 90. He's an incredible person. He's very short, about 5 foot one or two. He created, it's now called Aon, it used to be the Combined Insurance Companies of America, 26 insurance companies, $7 billion assets. And he became so taken by this that he said, you can put me down as the advisory board chairman for the Olympiads of Knowledge. I want you to use my name in any way you can. He said, this is a great dream. And as our relationship developed, he said, Landy, you go ahead. He said, I think that I can commit to provide up front $2 million to help fund this for you for the first time. Because that's what I told him. I thought it would be minimum to do it right. So I went ahead and invested in a lot of literature and promotional material. Now, here's the sad story. This began in 1976. Despite all the money I have done and the articles that people have written about, I have 50 paid U.S. subscribers. 50. Doesn't even cover anything. No interest whatsoever. Even science teachers won't buy it. The concept. They're too ingrained in their own interests. They can't do what Mark and Harold Urey did, see the future. And certainly I feel that. So, after I had invested this, we got hundreds of tremendous forms back with ideas to be in competition and be screened. But they all came from third world countries. Begging. I sent a copy of Knowledge, begging, please, Knowledge Magazine is so wonderful. It's manna from heaven.
but we have no money. We can't get any U.S. funds to send out of the country. These came from every country in the world, Russia, the whole European continent, Africa, Nigeria. I've got stuff that high. I'm trying to give them free subscriptions, but I don't know how long this can go on. They have no money. But they know the value of knowledge, and the Western world doesn't, especially the United States. Boy, I was heartbroken to see the complete indifference of many of my chemical friends. I think it's a wild idea, I guess, or something, I don't know. But I had to go to Denver to get the award for applied polymer chemistry from the ACS, the Phillips Petroleum Award. And I told Clem Stone that I would be able to stop in Chicago and bring ourselves up to date. And he reserved a room in the Admiral's Club, and his chauffeur brought him up. And he had tears in his eyes. We met in this private room, and he said, Landy, he said, I am going to have to renege on my promise. He said, what has happened is, he said, I guaranteed loans of up to $2 billion to my son-in-law, a physician, who, this famous surgeon in Houston.
DeBakey?
Yeah. And he said, what they did was they formed a corporation, and his son-in-law was a physician, not a businessman, but he supported him, mainly because he married his only daughter and so forth. And what they did is, the idea was that they would build elite structures near famous universities, like they were starting, they did with the DeBakey. And the idea was that these centers would be like Mayo clinics in different big cities where they have prominent physicians. What they failed to realize is that the number of people who can afford a DeBakey is so small. But they didn't realize that. They built these buildings, they committed billions of dollars around the world, and Clem Stone had guaranteed the money. And he said, Landy, he said, it's a disaster. He said, it's devastating my resources. And he said, I have to come good on those notes. And he said, I just can't see that under these conditions, risking even $2 million on a funding like this. So that just fell through. Mm. So I've been struggling to keep it going. I'm going to be writing more and more about it, and I'm afraid. Oh, the other thing I should say is that I send 100 copies of every issue to the Napoleon Hill Foundation, which is run by Clem Stone in South Carolina. And the Napoleon Hill Foundation feeds positive thinking to mainly 18-year-old men who are in jail. You know, they made a mistake. They got mad and they got into jail. And I give them, and if you would see the mail I get, again, they have no money to pay for the subscription, and it's costly because we don't publish that much numbers. Our advertising has never brought in any benefits. I sent 500 copies of this to the presidential awardees for the teachers. I haven't got one reply. With a covering letter and everything, no, not a single answer from 500,000 personalized letters to teachers who've received a presidential award for teaching in high school. Not a single one. And I can tell you, most of my paid subscribers are friends of mine. They're fine, but they're not the people we want to reach with this. So there's where we are. I don't know where we're going to go. I'm not going to give the idea up, but I can't see it happening in my lifetime. I would say 1,000 years from now, maybe, but I thought Harold Urey's comments and Mark's were so comforting, because here's two people who realize the importance of this Pareto event. So that's the story on the Olympiads.
Because it was, I guess, the year after you received the Grady Medal that you then, quote, retired, took early retirement, as it were.
Yeah, it was July 1, officially, 1974. And the reason I retired was the following. Mr. Connor called me in, and I had a 5-year contract with Newable. Very generous. So he said, now, Landy, you know, you've got so many other wonderful ideas, but we've got to get some of our money back from Avatine before we take the next one. And he said, that's going to take a few years. So he said, we'd be glad to renew your contract and give you some more stock options and keep your Cadillac and your office. All we want you to do is sit in your office and read the literature. When we need you, we'll call on you. Your salary will remain fixed. So I said, Bill, I would vegetate under those conditions. I just think, if you don't mind, I'd like to take early retirement at 57 and start my own research institute that I've always wanted to do. I have certain ideas about how to create an atmosphere that will accentuate the efficiency of creativity. And he said, well, that's fine. He said, we'll help you set up your lab. We'll keep you as a consultant for a while, and we'll back you up in any way we can. And however, because I took the initiative to resign, I had 15,000 shares of Alcon stock, but it was 1974, and I had the option at $17, but the stock was down to $11, and I only had 2 months to exercise it in, so I lost it all. But 3 years later, Nestle bought out Alcon and paid $46 for every option and every share. They wanted 100% ownership. So I lost 15,000 times 46 if I hadn't had to sell my stock. But that's fine. That's the price you pay for doing what you want. No regrets. Oh, man, my 17 years here have been heaven. I tell everybody that comes here, I don't know whether there's a heaven or not. But I'm telling you, I'm happy to say that I'm living it here and now as a real thing. And if it's there, it's a bonus. If it isn't there, I haven't missed anything. So I only wish that many, many other people could have the opportunity that I have exercised here through these Olympiad of Knowledge Institutes. Boy, it would change this planet. The big companies are so uncreative now. They're so burdened with fringe benefits and taxes and high salaries. They're more concerned about meeting their payroll now than they are about making new products. So it's sad. So that's the Olympiad story.
Well, have you been in this location since 74?
No. I bought this building in April 1983. I was located about a half a mile here in a Wedgwood shopping center with very modest offices. I mean, nothing like this. This building happened to become available. It's 14,000 square feet. my activities cover about half of it. The rest, some of it is rented out, but it isn't 100%. But we're making it because of my consulting and writing. There's still a great demand on my writing, and so, but it's a question. There's only so many hours in a day. I have some new consulting licensing agreements in the picture that are very encouraging. The Saudi group that was here yesterday, I feel sure, will sign a consulting licensing retainer. And, of course, Microtech Industries, which is going to pioneer all of the new polymer microcrystals. That's the gentleman that called me this morning that I have to talk to. That's a Canadian company that is expanding worldwide.
Well, when you started this in 74, there were two different names, as I see it. The Research Services Corporation, which is your consulting work, I would assume.
Yeah.
That's. But then you have the Research Institute. And I would like to go over some of the things that you've done here during that time. But how many people did you have, or have you had working at the Institute over this period of time?
Right. Over the past, 8 years, until this summer, I've always had two professionals and two technicians, deliberately, no more than that. I'll never have more than that. But I try to pick the people in the most careful way. Two of these have gone on for doctorate degrees. Actually, one had a BS degree in zoology from the University of Texas, and he couldn't get into graduate school chemistry. And after 2.5 years working with me, David Harris, I wrote to the chairman of the Department of Chemistry at the University of Dallas in Texas, and I told him that this young man is a cop-out but with a brilliant mind. And that he had done such fine work for me for 2.5 years, it would certainly, in my opinion, replace any deficiencies of the official curriculum for acceptance. And by gory, the chairman of the department agreed, and he's got his PhD in biochemistry. Jerry Taylor, he also had no, hardly any. He was a captain, retired from the Marine Corps. And he's the man who did the most to make my artificial ivory. This is all made, this is 11 or 12 years ago that Jerry made these two things, and they're as good as they were, and I wear them practically every day. And he went on, believe it or not, to become a chiropractor, get a degree, a doctor's degree as a chiropractor. Howard Callahan was a ministerial student at the Theological Seminary, a chemical engineer, and I got him a salary job at twice what I could pay him because I was a director of Carrington Labs, and an opening occurred, and I got him there. And Scott Lee, who was with me 6.5 years, he had a degree in chemistry, and he's gone on to get a doctorate. So I'm right now down to two technicians, and I'm phasing out because I want to have more time to write and lecture, and I've got a stable of products that that is so exciting that and I might point out is that I am getting away from filing patents because of their great expense. And what I am doing is I've just filed about 15 trademarks. A trademark is more valuable than a patent in many respects. And I just had my secretary. I'm going to be putting out a brochure, but here's the table of contents of more consumer-oriented inventions that I'd like to give you. And I'll see that you get the whole package with pictures and everything when it's done. But here is everything here except Avicel number one and Avatine is brand new inventions that I think have immediate commercial potential. And I have deliberately shifted gears to go to consumer products with no FDA hang-up. Because the minute you get involved today with the FDA, you're hopeless. A big company can't even afford it, let alone a small company. But that's something that illustrates the brochure that's going to be coming out. It'll have detailed descriptions of these inventions, plus, where possible, photographs. And this will bring me in a great many new clients. I have the Loctite Corporation coming here next Wednesday and Thursday to sign a contract. They're the people who created Crazy Glue.
Yes.
And they're very, very profitable New York Exchange company.
No, this would be excellent because I was going to ask you about some of the... how did you... I mean, there's quite a variety of products on here.
Yes.
You have disposable contact lenses and artificial ivory, for example.
Yes.
I mean, those are about as far away as you can get.
Or metallic concretes.
Yes.
Super concretes, yes. See, this is the idea of the Institute. There is... If we feel like it, we'll work on concrete this morning and a contact lens. It's the motivation at the moment that we allow the freedom of.
Okay.
And I think this is the key to the extent of innovation here.
Mm-hmm.
Run when it's just like writing. Write when the mood's there, mm-hmm. You see. But if an idea gets you excited this morning, go do it. Reduce it to praxis. Enter it in the notebooks. And then go back to what you were doing. FMC at their central research department would take 20 years to produce things like this.
Mm-hmm. And I think you told me yesterday that your budget is...
The what's...
Your budget is
about $300,000
yes.
a year.
Yes, it's amazing. And I also noticed you have three IR 100 awards, which...
Oh, yes, really, that was way back. I know that many of these things would have qualified, but I've never entered the competition. I did that while I was at FMC.
I see. Okay.
You have to put up a booth, and it's expensive. They're not as important as a $10,000 a month consulting contract, I
yes.
can tell you. To pay your bills with overhead, I'll tell you. Yeah.
You were also president of the AIC. You've been very active in the AIC for a long time. Any particular experiences there that...
Very good question. Number one, they gave me the Chemical Pioneer Award in 1969 at Saddlebrook. But the man behind it was Herman Mark. See? Unless your peers will take the initiative, nobody knows what you've done. But Herman Mark and Urey and people like that, they're looking to try to encourage other members of their profession to be recognized. You can't do it yourself. For instance, I didn't ask to be interviewed. You invited. It's only because you and your associates said, this man deserves attention. Otherwise, it wouldn't be considered. So you have to depend on other people with good meaning
and unselfishness to be recognized. You can't recognize yourself.
You've also written some songs.
Some what?
Songs.
Oh, yes. I wanted to be sure to talk to you about this because I'm a member of ASCAP. I can't play a piano. I don't know the first thing about reading music. But I love easy listening music. And I've now written 9 songs. I've put a lot of money in having them professionally prepared. I've received 1 royalty check so far from ASCAP. And this will interest you. A wonderful man, Mr. René Grandpré, who was the founder of Essilor, the biggest producer of spectacles in the world, and there, he licensed my contact lenses for a while and paid me very royally. And he would come visit me, and I would visit them in Paris. And among the songs, 2 of them he liked especially. One is Fort Worth. I can remember the 2 of us hand in hand walking down the Champs-Élysées singing, Fort Worth, I love you. But the song that brought the royalty is the song that I think is the best one, mainly because of the music and the lyrics. I write the lyrics and on a synchronizer try to get the tune, but then I pay for hire professionals. I've spent over $17,000 having these cassettes made, and they need further improvement. But they are enough, in a sense, professionally to try to find a record company that might take them over. But I've been too busy. Now, the other song is Come Along With Me, and the lyrics I like best. Now, Kemmons Wilson, the founder of Holiday Inns, has come here, and I've served as a consultant to him. And he's a remarkable man. He built 23,000 Holiday Inns, sold them, and now at 74, he's building Wilson Worlds all over the country. Just can't stop doing it. He listened to a 4-song cassette. It's called Come Along With Me. I had to write a Dallas one as well as a Fort Worth one or I'd get shot. And then the other one is called Arm's Length. It's easy listening. But my gosh, he listened to Come Along With Me and he was dancing all over that office as it was played. He thought it was tremendous. Whether it is or not, time will tell. But I had given Mr. Grandpré several copies of Fort Worth and Come Along With Me. And he must have given a copy of Come Along With Me, and it somehow reached a Belgian restaurant. And apparently they played it, and ASCAP in there picked it up. And I got a royalty of $26.75 said playing in a Belgian cabaret. Oh, but all 9 songs I have worked on it strictly as a side issue, but I enjoy listening to them occasionally when I'm alone. ASCAP is a great organization, but you have to have your music played publicly to become a member. And what happened was Brad Wright, a local man who came here to do a story on my Avery, he was so pleased with the Fort Worth cassette that he played it on Channel 5.
So that gave me the commercial playing that I needed. Otherwise, you can't become a member of ASCAP.
It's very interesting.
Yes. Quite a diversity of activities.
It's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. What do you... Let me pose two last questions, one retrospective and one looking ahead.
Yeah.
Over your long career in chemistry, what would you say have been the major changes in the discipline of chemistry over the time that you've been active?
It's hard for me to relate the experience of the past 17 years with my 30-some years in corporate life. If corporate life could be made somehow the way my present way of doing chemistry, and it would revolutionize the profession tremendously. The one thing that I found in the past was that working in a corporate environment, and this includes government activity, you really don't enjoy, despite people saying it to the contrary, you don't really enjoy when you walk into your office or lab what I enjoy, which I didn't have when I was with FMC. Such things as this. I think that I have my own restroom, for one thing. Even at Alcon, as a vice president, you didn't have any privacy. That's a little plus, not too important. But the main thing is that I don't have to go to meetings. Most of the people I try to contact, they're in meetings 80% of the day. They're chemists. I don't have that. Furthermore, Bausch & Lomb, for example, one of my big clients, is the most difficult company. They just sweat blood out of their executives. They put them under so much pressure. And the turnover then gets very high. But boy, if their budgets ever go over, they're dead. I mean, how are you going to think creatively if you suddenly realize that you're going to go over your budget and you're going to lose your job? You're worrying more about that than trying to create something new. Oh, it's a sin, the wastefulness. And I can tell you, the wastefulness in the government is even more than in corporate life. So we're pouring billions of dollars of wasted money down a rat hole because we're just not using our common science. That's why I want to create Olympiads of Knowledge. I want hundreds of institutes patterned on my experimental. I can prove that the institutes can be very profitable, but they've got to have the right director. And they've got to be flexible enough to adapt the attitude and the environment that we have deliberately created. Otherwise, it's no good. People have tried at FMC and many big companies say, oh, we're going to set over a little group here. No. They can't be on the same premises. There's so much backbiting and jealousy and scare of your job. We don't have any of that here. We need companies who the vice president will say, boy, if you can prove me wrong, I'll give you a bonus in 5 minutes. We've got to create an environment of no fear of the boss. My God, when a boss in a big corporation comes around, or the president, there's hysteria. That's awful. And it's there, and it's in the universities, too. When the head honcho comes around, everybody clicks their heels. So we got a big problem in the profession of chemistry ahead of us. And the other thing that I find that is, I think almost every profession is guilty of, there are too many professionals, even with the best credentials, who are comfortable being followers but not innovators. Boy, they'll jump on anything good that somebody else publishes and work on that, when they should be trying to initiate something new that other people can benefit from. The whole field of biotechnology, my God, there are more graduate students on DNA and antibodies, super saturated. And the other thing is that I'm convinced that what we need are very simple ideas. The simpler, the better. And once you get into the more complicated things, you may have to wait 100 years to find out the true value or lack of value of a new drug. How many new drugs, like Prozac and other things, have injured millions of people because they got it on the market? They have data that looks good, but every human being is a different chemical factory. That's not good science, that's just good marketing to make money. So these are some of... Now, I couldn't say these things if I was employed by a corporation. I'd be out the door in a minute. What I like is my freedom to be able to say it, and I'm not afraid of being quoted. They can't hurt me. I'm not on their payroll. They need my knowledge. So I have a feeling of independence that nobody in the world has greater feeling of independence than I have. And I won't give it up as long as I live. Oh, I only wish I could light a torch for other people to experience this. Gosh! When I get a letter from an 18-year-old person in jail for some minor thing, and the fella admits, you know, he said, it was terrible, I was wrong, I really made a mistake, but he's still going to have to serve the sentence out. Tragic.
Is there anything else you think we should cover?
Well, just one other thing is, I believe very strongly, from my experience in hiring professionals and non-professionals, I believe, Jim, that what the world is really missing is the tremendous potential in young men and women who are called cop-outs. I have taken cop-outs deliberately and converted them into very creative people. But a cop-out occurs because they hate the educational bureaucracy. They revolt, like David Harris. Because he had a degree in zoology, he was blocked from going on to do what he wanted, biochemistry. How much of this is going on? Somebody should analyze this. And save more money and get the deficit off in no time. We are not in an advanced state of logical reasoning in 1992. And I'm afraid it's true all over the world. And the solutions they're trying to create for them are band-aids. They're not getting to the fundamentals. And the fundamentals, what I mean by fundamentals, is experimental data. I don't believe anything, truly, unless other people can repeat it in other parts of the world independently. That's science. But a hell of a lot of non-science is nonsensical. You can quote me on this if you want. I really mean this strongly.
And I am going to be putting together something I've been planning for many years. And that is a book I want to write called Uphill All the Way. I have had to fight uphill to every success I've achieved. And I'll tell you, as president of the American Institute of Chemistry, I admired such people that I had occasion, like Max Tischler and Norman Hackerman, they're wonderful people, that I was at least part of the process of them being recognized. But, Jim, the politics of a professional organization like the ACS or the AIC is enough to nauseate you. It's absolutely nauseating. That was my biggest problem. I spent $30,000 a year of my own funds for 3 years traveling for AIC and trying to get it, and I did succeed. When I took over, it was $35,000 in the red. And when I finished, it was about $40,000 in the black. But that was because I paid all of my own expenses. I could have taken it and put them in more debt. And I thought I was, you know, trying to help the profession. But there's been no appreciation. Oh, man, I worked so hard for those 3 years. And the backbiting at board of directors meetings, the absolutely unsavory relationship between some of the key members of the profession is not nice. It's not good. Chemists need to learn more than chemistry. A profession is not just the subject of your expertise. It's the interfacing with all the other variables. But chemists are very lacking in that regard. They've got a very narrow track that they follow. I'm talking generally. There are many wonderful, and we've discussed so many wonderful ones, but I'm talking about the mass of the average people. Plenty of room for improvement. But I can tell you it's been a delightful 3 hours having you visit with me, and I want you to know, and please tell your associates of my appreciation.
Thank you very much. I certainly appreciate your spending the time. Thank you.